Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times. On our first Headlines event of the year, we welcomed Dr. Luca Tardelli, an assistant professorial lecturer in international relations at LSE. In our conversation, we discussed the aftermath of the US election and the implications of the result to US foreign policy.
Perfect. So we're delighted that Dr. Tardelli has taken time out to be our moderator today. I'm sure if you're in the International Relations Department, he really doesn't need an introduction. He has a PhD in International Relations from LSE and has taught various undergraduate and postgraduate programs. Currently, he's an assistant professorial lecturer and the departmental tutor. His research interests focus on international security, military intervention, and U.S. foreign policy. Really, we cannot think of anyone better suited for the event. So I won't take up any more time, as I'm really excited to get the discussion started. Dr. Tardelli, over to you.
Well, first of all, thanks, Tanvi. I mean, just want to say very quickly, thank you to the Grimshaw Club for inviting me, first. And second, I also would like to thank personally Tanvi for the patience she has demonstrated over the last month or so with me, especially with my delayed responses and so on. So thank you to Grimshaw, but especially to Tanvi for inviting me. I mean, you know, when Tanvi approached me and said, look, I'm pretty sure that, you know, the headline would be US elections, implications, problem. Anything connected to that. So happy to discuss this with you guys. You know, I can see a lot of actually familiar faces / names. So I already know a lot of you. So, and I'm more interested as well to hear your thoughts on this subject, because I'm sure you followed this. I'm sure we've lost hours of sleep on this topic. I definitely did. So if I say anything silly, actually, I'll blame my lack of sleep. I can tell you that. That is my excuse for anything weird I'm going to say today. But the key question, I mean, I'm going to start with some basic reflections. But as I said, as much as possible, if I understand how you would like to run these events, I'm interested to hear what you think as well. I mean, I think there is so much that has happened and not happened with these elections, in a sense. And we're exactly at that phase where we don't know where things are going. So we may have different assessments, I think, of the evidence or what the evidence is telling us so far. But I'm gonna kick off things with three reflections on these three elements. One is the election itself, so the results itself. I'm gonna say a few words on that. And this is maybe actually where we may have different assessments of this, I think, because we are exactly at that moment, I think, where we don't have the full picture of the results. We have some preliminary exit polls. So it's interesting to see how we're reading these elements. And it's part of the political process, by the way, to read these elements. So it is not just a purely objective effort. Okay, there's a lot of that, and I'll try to be as objective as possible. But there's not just that. There's also the political approach in which we look at this. Then I'm going to say very quickly a few things about what can go wrong. So basically, you know, I know and that's what we debate, I think, a lot of times these days. You know, what can go wrong with the election itself, with the transition to the Biden administration and so on? And I'll give you my very two cents on that. And finally, I think, I mean, we're doing IR, right? So in different ways and different forms. So just to get an understanding of where, and I'll just say a few things about where the foreign policy of this new administration will go and things to watch out for, things to keep an eye on, okay? I'll start with that and happy to take questions on anything on these issues and also on other things that you think would happen in the meantime. You know, it's not just the US election, right? Especially when something happens in the US, we tend to focus on that right away when it consumes our attention from other things that may have been happening in the world. I mean, I'll say this on the first point, the election. You know, and I'm not trying to, you know, although this is a more kind of informal event, but, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, to highlight any kind of, you know, provide any kind of judgment on, you know, whether I'm happy or not with the results. You know, it's secondary to this. I think for me, the kind of the interesting bit here, and probably it's, you know, I blame the kind of 2020 syndrome, I think. You know, even when I'm happy about results, I'm always worried that something bad will happen. So I'm not going to celebrate anything. I'm going to, you know, immediately declare my bias in all of this. So political bias, of course, I'm tentatively happy with the results. I think there are two points, however, that I want to mention on the election itself, and I'm happy to discuss this with you guys. The first one is actually a clearer victory than expected at some point. At some point, we thought actually things were going to be much more balanced. actually, it turns out that's not the case. Thanks to Pennsylvania, thanks to Wisconsin, thanks probably to Georgia and so on. So in a sense, that is one of the big stories, because I think at some point there was an expectation that that was not going to happen. However, what are the things that keep me a bit cautious about all of this? And actually, I think have implications for our conversation, especially for the implications on foreign policy and international relations. I mean, despite Biden's victory, this is really much an election that to me shows again that this is a deeply divided country. It shows shows a country where you may have, you know, a Democrat at the presidency, but where the Senate may remain a Republican Senate, which is not a bad or positive thing in itself. It's just a matter of objective fact that you may have ended up with a divided government. The Congress, representatives in Congress from the Republican side went up, actually not down. Importantly, state assemblies, which were very important. We tend to look just at the presidency, right? We tend to personalize things, but there's much more going on in these elections, right? So the state assemblies, again, Republicans gained in the state assemblies, and these will be important for the future, I think. This will be important, especially when we're looking at the new census, when you look at the new district, at the issue of gerrymandering in the United States. So I think in this sense, we should focus a little bit more on what happened in the state assemblies. And of course, the referenda as well that happened. I think, you know, for any kind of celebratory moment when, you know, we may think that maybe, you know, this is a reaction against certain policies or certain approach of the Trump administration, the referenda gave us a very mixed picture. I mean, there's the referendum in Florida, gives you a sense of the need, right, to raise minimum wages. But at the same time, the referendum in California told us something about the need not to consider certain workers as actual workers or salary workers, right, but as contractors and so on. So the picture, again, is very mixed, and it's not giving us, at least not to me, and I'm interested to see if you have a much more positive assessment here of the election. But to me, it's something that maybe, again, it's my 2020 syndrome, but I'm not entirely happy with the results. I think it's something that would create particular problems for this presidency. There's more to be said. I think the exit polls are also giving us, I think, an interesting picture of what happened. But happy to expand this during the discussion. So what can go wrong? I mean, at minimum, if this very broad assessment is right, you know, if this is still a divided and polarized country, and whether we like it or not, this is going to shape and affect any Biden's presidency and action. In particular, I think, you know, there's a twofold risk now. One is the risk of just, you know, shrugging ourselves and said, you know, nothing happened, right? I mean, everything would work as, yeah, no, maybe Trump is not complaining, but it's Trump, right? You know, everything would go as normal. Once you take this craziness factor of Trump, then things will go as normal. We'll have a normal transition. Everything will be fine. The other risk, and this is, again, something we may disagree on, but the other risk for me is really the risk of over-exaggerating what can be done by Trump in this situation. The recounting is important, but up to a point. I mean, recounting in some cases is a technical issue and usually never leads to anything. The legal action is less normal. But even in that case, I struggle to see how all this legal action will actually change the picture. Like, I don't see the technicalities of it. And, you know, it could delay things, but I can't see things happening in a very problematic way. Of course, we can be concerned about Trump being Trump and doing something much worse. But again, I probably it's because I don't take him that seriously. I mean, in order to do something very serious and very dangerous, you need to be a really serious and smart person. I don't know if that is the case in this case. But apart from that, there are limitations. I think all our assessment should be based and automatically are based on particular assessments on the quality and status of American democracy. I think for all its problems, and there are many, and we can discuss that, I think, you know, I cannot see the problems that would trigger concern in terms of there won't be any transition to the Biden administration. And yet, there could be something in between. I think the twofold risk is to say, oh, everything is fine, it's normal, or look, we're going to go to an attempt coup or a coup or anything like that. I think in between there's much else that could happen, and I'm happy to discuss this with you. But look, the increased polarization and divisions coming from a president that says, I'm not going to respect this result, is already there. That is nothing, you know, that to me is already the big story. But, you know, this president and this administration and the Republicans can make the transition difficult. Even basic things like sharing intelligence with the incoming administration, it's not happening apparently. And, you know, it takes a while to have these transitions, you know, it takes months, it takes a lot of work. So anything that delays that will be a problem for Biden. Staffing, especially if the Senate remains in Republican hands, staffing of the executive branch would be a problem. It would, the Senate and the Congress could delay any appointments. So again, another problem. And I think there are issues, and to me, that is the thing to watch out, is the implications for foreign policy. What I really think we should talk a little bit more and less about other concerns is what the Trump administration can do in order to complicate the picture for American foreign policy in the next administration. I'll talk about this, but one classic case is Iran. I think, you know, we're not that far away from a new round of sanctions against Iran. And the reason is not just because it's what the administration wants to do, but it's also because it wants to complicate or derail certain decisions by the Biden administration. So I think our foreign policy will play a role into this. And finally, what to expect on foreign policy. I mean, we can discuss hours on this, and I'm happy to take questions on this as well and to discuss this with you. But I think, can we expect change? Yes, to an extent. I mean, I think at the very beginning, there will be some healing on basic things. All the decisions made by the Trump administration that were aimed exactly at polarizing the political discourse or polarizing, you know, the voters. Think about a travel ban. Think about all the decisions about, you know, dividing, you know, children from their parents and families at the border. All of these measures could be changed relatively quickly. And, you know, in a sense, the country needs that kind of healing. Paris, yes, the Paris Agreement. Iran, I'll put a big asterisk on Iran. Happy to clarify why I think it's things that would be a little bit more complicated there. But in general, I think the change would be kind of coming back to discourse of American leadership, American values. It's already happening. Have a look at the article that Biden himself wrote with his advisors in foreign affairs. He basically said that, you know, it's back to American leadership. We have to pick up the pieces and we need to go back to American leadership. Connected to that is the focus on democracy. I mean, it was very clear how important that was in his own kind of thinking. And it's not just his thinking, it's all the policy advisors there. By the way, Biden has an enormous team of policy advisors. Comparing that to Trump, of course, it's not a good comparison, but it's, you know, let's remember that Biden was very much a foreign policy vice president, right? He was also brought in for his expertise and networks in this sense. So, and he's bringing in all this big team of people, so we can discuss that. I'm happy to discuss that. So this focus on back to American leadership, democracy, cooperation and allies. I think these will be keywords that will remain, especially in the short term. Whether then it will deliver, again, happy to discuss this. Problems to keep an eye on, Iran, and I can mention later on why. I don't think the China tensions are going away. I think I have my own assessment to that, and I talk about this also with others, but I don't see this changing very quickly for different reasons that I'm happy to expand. Is it going to be back to normal? Probably in the discourse, probably in a lot of decisions, especially in the healing process that I mentioned. But let me point out one thing. A lot of people, whether at the UN or NATO, are gonna, you know, I've looked at this with the kind of, okay, this is, you know, finally we're back to normal. Finally, a bit of, you know, sigh of relief and all of that. But it doesn't mean that everything can go back to normal that quickly, guys. I mean, let me point this out. It's not just an issue that, you know, the image of the soft power of the United States has been damaged. It takes a while, but it's not that. I mean, this could happen again. I mean, if I were sitting in a European capital, I would be thinking about that. I say, okay, good, Biden has won. But can this happen again in the future? I cannot bet on that anymore. And that is a problem. So happy to discuss this. And finally, you know, what are the issues to think about? How Trump can complicate Biden's foreign policy, as I mentioned. Allies, as I said, maybe it won't be that straightforward. I think the example here is Obama. I mean, Obama came to power with the idea, I'm going to restore our relations with the allies, especially, you know, our traditional allies. It didn't end up that well. Okay, let's remember that. There are reasons for that. And finally, can I just end up, because you know me, I mean, those who know me, I know, you know, that I'm a complete IR nerd. So I need to chuck in IR theory somewhere, someplace, somehow. It's interesting because I think a lot of the tensions, foreign policy will become important for also another reason, because it will be one of the points where the Democrats will fight amongst themselves. And it's already started, by the way. It's nothing that will happen in the future. It's already started from the more progressive side of the party that wants more change to those who actually that don't want that much change. I mean, for them, change is back to normalcy, right? It's back to traditional foreign policy, liberal internationalist foreign policy. And I think that, you know, watch that space, because it's already happened. The appointments of the team would be very important to this. And also, you know, it's all this debate, the AR theory bit comes in this, all this debate between change and the blob, the foreign policy established in Washington. I think watch one person in particular, Jake Sullivan. Jake Sullivan is one of the main advisors of Biden. He was mainly a foreign policy advisor. Now he's working more on domestic affairs. So it's not, I mean, we'll see. He may still end up in a kind of foreign policy position. But, you know, he wrote a few articles on foreign affairs, so you can read them and to see his thinking. But he also wrote a scathing critique of Stephen Walt and Mersheimer's latest books. Why? Because they were criticizing American foreign policy and the blob, the foreign policy establishment. And his retort was, you don't get it. You never worked in policymaking, right? So you don't even know what we're talking about in policymaking. And he had different ideas, right? So if the realists were saying, look, don't go to more interventions, don't do liberal internationalism, retrench, do offshore balancing, his reaction was, you don't quite understand how it works, right? So it's interesting to see that. I think that debate will become more and more important. I've talked too much. I'll stay there. Happy to expand on everything, but I'm more interested now in knowing what you think in terms of the elections, your assessment, the implications for foreign policy or anything else. I mean, if you have any questions, you've taken me, actually, I should say this. You allow me to be away from meetings and other things, much more boring things. So please keep me here with many questions as possible, okay? You're saving me today.
I can start. I was wondering if you think, to what extent will foreign policy be even a priority now? Because it seems like even during the presidential debates, they barely or never talked about foreign policy. And when you look at the kind of the squad and AOC and the progressives, they don't talk about foreign policy. I kind of feel like the establishment Democrats are much more liberal interventionists and liberal internationalists than they. So I'm not sure if Joe Biden is going to try to keep the party together and you know, get them on board, but what does that mean for foreign policy? Because I feel like the progressives are much more concerned about domestic issues. I don't even know what their stance is. I just feel like it's leave every war, never again, not intervene. I don't even know what their stance is, to be honest, but what does that mean for the future of US foreign policy?
I mean, do you want me to immediately give you my reactions and then we, you know, up to you?
Yeah, sure. We can have more people bring in their own ideas.
I mean, I'll say a couple of words and then, you know, you tell me. But I would say a couple of things on that. I mean, the first thing is this. So we always, and it's quite a kind of recurrent theme, right? I mean, it's not that foreign policy always plays a big role in the presidential debates and, you know, in the elections. Usually it's quite rare when that actually happens. I mean, I still belong to the generation that, you know, for us, you know, the Iraq 2003 thing was, right, that was the big thing, right? So where foreign policy was so central. But otherwise, it's never that central or that important. And yet, couple of things I would say. One more general one specifically to your point, Beatrice, which I think is very important and to me is where I ended. Watch that space, because I think foreign policy would matter because of the problems it could create to the Democrats, because of the divisions. But I would say a couple of things. First, a lot of the focus on the domestic side, I think Biden has said this, in a sense, by the way, is not that different from the approach that Obama had at the very beginning of his first term, where you said, well, we need to focus first on our democracy at all. Right, we need to heal at home first before we do anything else. However, in order to do that, we need to keep an eye on foreign policy. We need to, you know, make sure that, you know, democracies are, you know, helping each other, that we're helping also our democratic regimes, whether could we protect them from Russian interference, from other interference. So this link between domestic and foreign policy is already there and will push them already. I mean, just one thing, Biden has already said that he wants to bring this summit for democracy in Washington. You know, it's going to be his first initiative, which is, to me, that's, you know, that's a big one in the sense that, you know, if we go back a few years back, that would have been a thing that the Republicans would have done. But now, no, because now democracy at home is in, you know, probably in tatters or is in peril. So this link has already been done by the Biden administration. The second thing is the team. At the moment, the majority of the team is exactly part of the kind of liberal internationalist, you know, kind of people and experts. The progressives are really few. And the progressives, what do they want? I think it's clear that they want much more change, to me. I mean, they've expressed this actually very clearly. We want more change. Maybe sometimes you're right. I would agree, by the way, with your assessment, Beatrice, here personally, and I'm interested in others' perspectives on this, but in a sense that maybe they should clarify a little bit more what they want in positive terms as well. So just saying end in major wars. That is already something that, by the way, the foreign policy establishment in Washington kind of agrees with that. But I think it's already there that they want more change and they're not happy with some of the people that may be appointed, right? So I think that there's this kind of tension that could become more important, and that's what will make foreign policy much more important. The other one is what Trump could do now with Iran, Iranian sanctions, with China. I was really worried about China if he had won, but he hasn't won, so now I'm kind of relieved. But at the same time, you can make things very complicated on Iran. So I think those political dynamics at home will make foreign policy more important, paradoxically. I think that would be my two cents on that, Beatrice.
Thank you. We have some questions in the chat. Would you guys want to unmute and say the questions yourselves, or do you want me to say it? Either is fine. Joshua?
Okay, I see
you. Okay, I'm Ms.
Hey, sorry. Sorry, yeah. I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, two things. Actually, yeah, was what do you think Biden's foreign policy and his approach to China would be, particularly with issues such as Taiwan, the South China Sea, and also maybe adding on to that, you said before you would have been worried if maybe with regards to China, if Trump had been reelected, and I'm wondering why in that regards.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want me to take this question right away, Tanvi?
Yes, I think that's best, and then we can do the others.
So let me start from the last one. And so my worry, and it wasn't just my worry, by the way, but it was basically to say that, you know, if Trump had won, what was the concern around was that it would feel emboldened and, you know, and basically authorize to, you know, to say, look, my approach won, right? I now have either 4 years, my approach, especially on certain issues, including China, has been vindicated. And I think the worry was that it would have, you know, made something crazy or it would have escalated things. I mean, the situation, especially in the region, especially with regard to Taiwan, is not the best, right? So in a sense, there was this worry around that it would have basically escalated things or would have just been vindicated with some kind of expression of, you know, of his own, you know, confidence in this. You know, we know Trump, we know how he's expressed things in the past. And there was this worry that at least the messaging would have gone in the wrong direction at the wrong time. And, you know, and you know, that was the kind of worry that this could escalate in a weird way very quickly. So the innocence is out. We still have the possibility. I mean, everything is possible. But, you know, that, you know, it will try to, again, to increase tensions with China, again, to make things complicated for Biden. Although I'm less clear how that will work out at this moment. You know, that I'm less clear, but everything is possible. On Biden, so I think, and this is, you know, when I mentioned what could change, I immediately said, you know, what is it unlikely to change for me? And for me, I don't see how much things will change with regard to China. And this is, there is a, you know, a set of factors. Part of it is just simply structural factors. I mean, US will remain geared towards China. China will matter in US foreign policy for a long time. This will not change. And there will, this pattern of cooperation and competition will stay either way. So we won't go with, you know, the measures that Trump has taken in terms of, you know, the protectionist and all that. But again, if you read what Biden has said and what his foreign policy advisors have said so far, they're very clear that, you know, China is a competitor, that, you know, is posing a challenge in different ways and in different forms, okay, economic, technological, then the United States should step up. And a lot of this is just, by the way, simply saying we need to invest at home in order to compete with China. So it's nothing adversarial per se. But again, the framing of all of this is to say, you know, it's not that we're going to go to, you know, this kind of, you know, shift from contrast to partnerships and we will manage things together all of the times. So, I mean, maybe in climate change issues, you know, especially with regard to the Paris Agreement, but not necessarily on other things, on the economy, on the presence, and with Taiwan, and I would say even Hong Kong. To me, there are two question marks in all this. First is the fact that if you see where, you know, some of the votes, key votes that Biden has taken are in the Midwest. And, you know, this is where, you know, the competition from China, economic competition you know, has moved votes in the past. So in a sense, there is also that to keep an eye on. And I think Biden has defined his foreign policy as a foreign policy for the middle class, which to me is, you know, allow me to joke, has always been a foreign policy for the middle class in the United States. I don't ever think that it was a foreign policy for the elites only, right? But it's to what extent, you know, the need to protect some jobs will count in that effect. And the second one is this emphasis on democracy. I mean, if the emphasis is on democracy, even to the point, by the way, that some have said, I think it was one of these, I don't remember if it was the previous advisor of Obama, Ben Rhodes, or even some of his policy advisors that said, you know, we can even rephrase and reframe NATO and the EU as an alliance of democracies. I mean, this means one thing, that you're not very happy and you're siding against the autocracies here, right? Which is maybe Russia, first and foremost, probably even China. And I think, you know, part of the debate, I think it was Ben Rhodes, he said, you know, we should be at the forefront of protest and revolution. For us, at home, it's Black Lives Matter. And we can matter in that way in the world. We can be a beacon for change. But we're just part of a movement, right? There's protests everywhere. There's protests also in Hong Kong. And when I read it, I thought, this is not going to help. You could agree with that, by the way. You could say that is fantastic, right? But it's not going to help with your relationship with China. So I don't see at the moment much change, also because the Republican Party is clearly, I mean, it shifted so much on China, but it's now clearly, you know, the approach against China is very clear in the Republican Party. So they want more of that. So with Taiwan, we're also victim of events, by the way, depends on how things develop. But I don't see things in relationship improving that much that quickly, actually. That would be my point.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Francis. Would you like to unmute yourself, or should I? Okay, I think I'm just going to say it. I was wondering what your thoughts are on how financial markets and asset prices have reacted so far to Biden's victory, given that a Democrat administration would mean a push both for fiscal stimulus but also higher corporate taxes.
I mean, Francis, thanks for this question, and hi. I mean, I won't comment much on this because I'm not an expert on financial markets and I don't want to give you commentary that is not based on any basic expertise on this. But I would say this one thing. I mean, financial markets, in a sense, reacted to the simply, I mean, two things are important usually in these cases. One is stability, right? I mean, anything that went in the direction of this is going to be a really long process in terms of not knowing who's going to win, that is what really scared people. And I think that's why that was my first point at the beginning. I said the fact that actually, ultimately, Biden has clearly won, and there are no doubts apart from the recounting, that is what mattered at some point. So the reaction, every reaction was shaped by that at the beginning. On the fiscal, you know, the fiscal stimulus, in a sense, I need to see it. I mean, I think, can I just make a joke on this? I mean, I need to see whether the administration will actually end up with that. Again, the divided government, the ability to pass bills that could actually make huge impact, you know, being able to ask Congress for a lot of money. I need to see that. I need to see that. In a sense that, you know, I'm not so sure whether some part, at least, of the response of the markets is also shaped by these ideas that it's not so sure that, you know, this will end up with higher taxes, much higher taxes, much, you know, this big stimulus. I don't know. We need to see that. That's my two cents on the political side. I'll leave the more kind of technical answers to the experts in financial markets, but that is my two cents on that.
Sarah also has a question, and unfortunately her microphone is really bad, so I think I'm just going to read it out for you. She says, thanks, Luca, it's quite insightful. What should we wait from Biden's victory in terms of implications in the Middle East, and especially in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? How does Biden's opinion on Iran affect the conflict?
So the thanks, Sarah, for this also, because it's one of the issues that is very close to my heart. So U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East and, you know, what is going on there. So the general approach to this, and this has been going on, I mean, I tend to look for patterns in things. I'm less interested sometimes in change. I'm a boring kind of old-fashioned realist. I want to see patterns and recurrences rather than changes. You know, for a while, the approach, the basic approach has been the same. You know, we should avoid any major involvement, military involvement in the Middle East. By major, I mean major, things like Iraq 2003. So that is the kind of basic consensus on the Middle East. And it's, you know, shared also by, you know, the so-called blob, the foreign policy establishment, which doesn't mean lack of any involvement, especially the lack of any military kind of involvement in the region. Okay, I think there's always a little bit of confusion. And again, Biden himself has said this. I said, you know, I'm not keen on any major involvements, and I'm not keen on any major military involvements in the Middle East. It's quite clear that he wants to continue the approach taken by the Obama administration on, retrenching and taking away soldiers from the so-called never-ending wars, right? In the Middle East or the broader region, what, you know, usually United States policymakers look at this kind of as if, you know, everything is a big Middle East, but which is problematic in many different ways. But think about Afghanistan, okay? They usually connect this. So they're very clear about this. But in the same time, they've been very clear that you can intervene in different ways. I think Biden in his article in Foreign Affairs mentioned special forces, you know, and other forms like that. So, you know, that could still happen. And by the way, you know, the episode of what happened in Iraq and Syria with ISIS, I think is still there for the American foreign policy makers. You know, events on the ground can lead the United States to intervene in a different way. There will be definitely more kind of emphasis on diplomacy. This has just been said, but to the extent that they can stick to that, I think it depends a lot on events on the ground. So I think the basic line is that. On Iran and Israeli-Palestinian conflicts, I quite like this question for a reason, because I haven't seen much on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict said by the foreign policy advisors. There's some sense that, I'm not sure, you know, whether this is just paying lip service to basic tenets of democratic foreign policy. But I know for sure that, you know, there was this clear line that, you know, the United States should continue supporting Israel. You know, there's this clear commitment. I didn't read, probably it's just my limited time that I had so far, I didn't read much on what they could do or they think about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In general, by the way, I mean, again, I belong to a generation that, you know, if you studied IR, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would have been the first thing that you would have to study. I'm not joking. I mean, we all knew about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I doubt that is the case. It's now fallen down so much in the ladder of priorities that, why in a sense, investing so much effort into that is sad to say, but that's my view on that. Iran is much more complicated, and it goes back to the issue of that I mentioned before. I mean, it's clear that the Biden administration wants to go back to the JCPOA, wants to, you know, to make sure that the deal works. But two things. A, Trump could complicate things. The Republicans more generally could complicate things with new sanctions. And by the way, Tony Blinken, one of his key foreign policy advisors, has said this. I said, we want for the deal to work, provided that Tehran plays ball with us, right? And it doesn't behave badly, which to me is diplomatic jargon to say, well, no, not so fast. We want to see behavior from Iran, and then we will change, which to me, this is a big question mark, because, you know, if that is the case, I don't know what is good behavior in this sense. I think Iran has been pretty cool so far in terms of the response. So I think I will leave it at that, but happy to expand on this.
If I could just quickly ask you to also talk about Saudi Arabia and war in Yemen. Thank you, Beatrice. While talking about Biden's foreign policy.
So this is where I think so far, I mean, if I need to, you know, create, you know, kind of list of capitals that are a little bit worried about Biden's victory, I think, you know, the Riyadh, in a sense, is there at the top of the list, thinking, God, we lost somebody who's really a friend here. Because, I mean, let's see what happened recently, in terms of relations with Saudi Arabia, with the Emirates. And some of it is just purely structural and longstanding. I mean, it's nothing to do with the Trump administration. But, of course, the contacts were much more personal in this case. Okay, so one is that element. With this specific issue of the war in Yemen, they've been pretty clear. I mean, the Biden administration and his foreign policy advisors have been clear so far. I mean, that's something that, you know, they want to incentivize / pressure Saudi Arabia to stop it. And, you know, that in a sense, they've been much clearer about this than the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I would say. On this, they've said it explicitly. They're on record to say, we don't, you know, this has to stop. It's not helping, right? Now, to what extent then they will implement this, they will actually do something about it, is a completely different story. I mean, all the things that I'm saying are based on likely conditions and what they've said. It might be that in 1 year time, you know, they realize that, you know, events change the situation. But at the moment, they've been pretty clear about this, I would say.
Vandana had a question. Would you like to ask yourself?
Yeah, sure. I was just wondering what Biden's win would mean to the American people in terms of their political leaning. I think the past 4 years have been largely characterized by the rise of populism, and there are clear statistics to prove that, you know, there's the retreat of the West and that there's less support for liberal internationalism. So I was just wondering how the Biden administration would be able to create a shift back into liberal internationalism from populism, or even if that's possible in the first place. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Thank you.
I could add something.
Yeah.
If you could also talk a little bit about EU relations and US-NATO relations while talking about this.
Yeah. Okay. So, Vandana, kind of easy question, but it's a big question. I would say this, I think it's a core question, because it goes to, this is between the domestic and foreign policy, I think. And I think, and this is, again, we'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Vandana, but also the others. My sense is this. So there is the support for, you know, public opinion support in the United States for the so-called liberal international order. We can discuss hours about, you know, what about it? Maybe we need to disentangle different things, free trade, international organizations, I mean, and so on and so on. But I think what this, for me, there's a big story here. If these elections are telling us a story of still of polarization and division, and if the Biden administration will find it hard to implement significant radical changes, especially at home, and, you know, I'm thinking about from technical things like, you know, tackling the issue of gerrymandering, from to social policies and, you know, investments in areas where actually there are people that are, you know, have suffered through neoliberal policies and may need a little bit of help. All through this, and if this is going to be difficult, then my sense is that Biden cannot do much to change what is a much longer structural shift, which goes under the issue of polarization. I mean, the support for liberal internationalism in the United States was, you know, as my colleague, Professor Trubovitz, you know, reminds us, rested on, you know, Cold War imperatives. So there was an international element to it. And second, rested on bipartisanship and consensus at the center. Without those two elements, it's difficult to sustain. I think Biden can improve things. I think, you know, especially with the healing process and some basic measures, to have a much more normal discourse, not fueling continuously this idea that, you know, the world is bad, globalization is bad, and everything is bad. It will help, but to an extent. For me, these are much more structural shift that I don't see how, without much radical change, much radical investments, you know, this could change overnight, or in any case, in 4 years' time. That is my big worry. And done. I mean, for me, that is the big thing. That is the big story. That's what makes your question important for me. I'm relatively negative and pessimistic about that. I hope, you know, if you tell me, look, you're completely wrong, this can change in 30 different ways, please tell me. But I don't see at the moment the assumption, context, you know, variables that are required to make much and to create a much bigger shift in this. I think Trumpism or polarization is going to stay here for a while in the United States. And sorry, you had a question on EU-NATO relations. Tambi, I mean, this is a big question as well. I would say this, I mean, it goes back to a point that I made earlier. Big sigh of relief in many European capitals. I mean, they just, you know, they just avoided the kind of emboldened second term Trump way, you know, especially at the beginning, they could have just stepped up and escalated his, you know, his own approach. So much more predictable president, which is good. Predictable stability could be boring, but it's good. I like boring in 2020, by the way. I mean, I don't mind it for a little bit of kind of calm and prediction. There's also one thing, by the way, that I want to mention. I mean, Biden is very well connected with the European leaders. And, you know, he's been part of the, you know, the committees in the Senate. He's been meeting ambassadors since, like, probably, you know, I wasn't even born. I mean, it's just, you know, he has a lot of connection with European capitals and that. And I think particularly in Germany, they will be looking at this with particular favor. I mean, the links between, you know, Biden knows probably, you know, very well all the former ambassadors, German ambassadors in Washington. And I think that is a story of kind of approaching and kind of, you know, shores of the Atlantic that are closing up. However, what I mentioned before, if I were, and I'm not, so, you know, take my words with a pinch of salt, but if I were sitting now in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, one thing that I would say is, okay, this is great for the next 4 years, but will this happen again? You know, now politics doesn't think too much in the long term. So probably if I had written a policy memo like this, they would just look at me and say, thank you, Luca, but we need to survive tomorrow. We don't care about what's going to happen in 4 years. But it's going to be a worry, right? I think, as I said, it's not just an issue of soft power or image of the United States here. It could be an issue of, you know, can Biden sustain this, right? Could go for a second term, if not him, another Democratic president that could go like this, or a Republican president that won't change again back to something else. And I think on that front, my sense is that they will keep an eye on this and they're not 100% sure. So what you can see now is that they will have this long-term worry. And in the short term, the only thing to keep an eye on is this shift to emphasis to democracy, the summit of democracies, any kind of push towards this is, you know, we need to stick and, you know, democracies need to stick with each other. I think it's going to be welcomed, but up to a point. You know, especially if this requires antagonizing Russia a little bit more. I mean, some countries in Europe are not keen on that. They want calm and predictability, no more tensions. Or, you know, especially now that Europe, European Union especially, started increasing its strategic autonomy, there's always this tension between the United States asking Europe to do more by itself, to be more autonomous. And then when Europe does a little bit more, there's also the other tension saying, don't do too much. Okay, that's enough. Okay. And I think we've seen this with the Trump administration, paradoxically, that it was asking Europeans to take care of themselves. But I think we could see this also with the Biden administration. And again, Obama didn't end up in a good place with Europeans, paradoxically again. So, you know, back to normal a little bit, but not that everything is perfect from now on.
Sorry, if I could just ask quick follow-up questions. I know we have a lot of questions in the chat, privilege. I was just wondering what it means for the Electoral College. I know that in the past it has become a significant issue because Trump was the second time that this happened, that the popular vote and the Electoral College were not the same. So do you think there'll be a greater push for reform there, or it's just, it's too big of an issue to actually see any sort of change?
Quick answer to that. I think it's just too big now to change. Although one thing, I mean, the issue could be circumvented by states deciding individually in different ways. Okay. I mean, it's not, you know, it doesn't require only a constitutional change on this. Okay. I mean, depends on how, and there is basically, you know, a reform process going on, you know, asking states to basically take the lead on this. It's just that, again, state assemblies in the United States have gone more Republican in a sense. So there's not been a big change in that. And it's a big change now. Again, we're talking about a polarized country, divided country. I don't see that happening right away. I don't see, and to be honest, you know, and I know I probably have an unpopular position on this. I don't think, I mean, it would be great if there had been, you know, if that could be reformed, but I don't think it's actually a priority. I mean, if I have to pick from a panoply of options, one thing to change would be, you know, the Senate itself. I mean, if I could change anything, I would say, you know, how the Senate gives minorities a lot of power. I mean, think about, you know, giving two seats to countries that are, you know, really have 100,000 people, right? It's just the imbalance there is huge. But the Electoral College, I don't think is going to happen soon. And in the case, I'm not so sure it's actually that needed. I mean, we do care about this because we've seen complex situation. It's very hard to understand sometimes. And, you know, it somehow affects American democracy's image abroad, right? But, you know, it's a system we know very well.
So we have a couple of questions. I think I'll just read them out to you all at once, and then you can take like 2-3 together. Joshua, would you like to read your own question, or should I just quickly go through them? Beatrice, do you think it's better if I just quickly go through them?
Yeah, sure. You can read it out.
Okay, perfect. So he's asking about why Trump fired Mark Esper recently. Is there like an ulterior motive with regards to the election result? And then we have one more question by Gia. Would a Biden administration affect economic and political relations with the UK following Brexit, since Biden has expressed concerns regarding the internal market bill of the Boris cabinet? And Yeah, I think should we just take these two and then I'll go on to the last question.
Thank you. This is a very good question. I like it. The Mark Esper one. Why did he get fired? Now, if I could only travel in Trump's mind, but I think the first reaction was, okay, this is worrying. This goes back, by the way, to the question that was asked before about, you know, why were you worried about, you know, an escalation with China? And I think the first reaction was exactly about this. I said, why did he get fired? Was it because he was trying to push for some action in South China Sea or around Taiwan as some kind of messaging to China? I think at the beginning that was the kind of fear. And I don't think that is the case. I mean, here is a bit kind of hearsay and all that, but I think there are two points. One, let's remember that Trump is a very peculiar president where, you know, if somebody contradicts him, especially publicly, usually they don't last long. And Esper did that. Okay, so that's strike number one. Strike number two, it seems, and again, it's hearsay, so you can check this because this is a bit of an evolving story, at least since yesterday. It seems that actually Russia has something to do with it. It seems that basically Trump was probably interested in this, in making available and public available some information, some intelligence assessment on Russia's interference in the US elections. And this has created a lot of tensions with his foreign policy people and defense secretary as well, and the CIA head as well. And I think the resistance to disclosing this information was because I think especially from the CIA side of things, they didn't want, I mean, they were really worried basically that methods of collection of sources and actual sources would be compromised. And Trump would just probably wanted to do this just to say, look, you see, the Russians didn't support me. And I think this created another tension. And it's quite clear that there was a meeting with the CIA head. But apparently, and again, it's hearsay more than anything, apparently, actually, even the defense secretary was involved in this debate. Again, it got the worst part of it, probably by getting fired. The other thing I just say, by the way, it just doesn't help in regard to the transition. I mean, really, firing the Secretary of Defense now, you know, it doesn't really help the Biden administration in terms of managing the transition and making sure that things are under control. But that's my two cents based on what I've read so far. I think that's probably where things come from. On the UK one, I think it doesn't help the UK, but even the Trump administration, I mean, have a look at what, you know, the last discussion they had on the trade deal, you know, and everything. I mean, on the UK side, it was clear, said, well, look, we have support, we can continue with the trade deal. From the American side, what the US administration, the Trump administration has said to the UK, yes, we can talk as much as you want, but provided every solution respects the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland. In the UK, this was just completely overlooked. Just say, no. I mean, the Johnson administration was just stressing how friends we are and all that. The reason why I'm raising this is because even with Biden would make things just more complicated, but even with Biden, or even just if Trump had won, I mean, this has been the kind of, you know, illusion that the United States would have just, you know, helped the United Kingdom with a trade deal. I mean, they said it from the beginning, you know, you're down the list. The European Union matters more, period. Second, there's also the issue of Northern Ireland peace agreement. They're very clear that there's as to say nothing should affect that. Okay. And I think Biden would only just stress this even more, more loudly probably. But the problem is structural. And I think there've been the UK government has been overselling this possibility for so long. It's one of the many illusions connected to Brexit, one of the many. So yes, it will change in tone, yes. But the basic policy is still the same and would be the same, I think.
We have a question by Jeremy and then one by Anderson. I'll just quickly read those out. So Jeremy says that has Trump's foreign policy actions just been noise and can easily be reversed by Biden, where foreign policy leaders of other countries will see Biden's presidency as a reset point in their relations with the US? Or has Trump's foreign policy approach permanently changed the international community's view of the U.S. and laid foundations for a different foreign policy approach that the U.S. will take moving forward, as compared to, say, during Obama's presidency? Anderson has a similar question about foreign policy. He talks about whether current expectations that Biden will only be a one-term president at the most will affect or undermine the responses to his foreign policy overseas.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Jeremy. My sense, and this is connected in part to what I said before, in part we can expand on this. And I think it'd be interesting to see if you have different ideas, by the way, on this, because for those of you, I don't know if there is any, by the way, now I'm just checking the names. If you are in the course that American Grand Strategy, we're going to discuss actually this question in week 10. So, you know, don't tell them what I'm going to say, otherwise it's spoiler alert and I don't have my class plan anymore. But so I don't think there's an issue of image and view. I don't think that can be healed, that can be addressed, that can be, I think that is not so worrying for me. I mean, I think, as you said, especially if there are on the other side leaders that are keen on cooperating with the US, are keen on putting things back to normal, I think you're right. Things will get to normal in terms of the discourse, in terms of everything pretty soon, pretty quickly, and that is great. But I think we need to talk about, you know, the extent to which, you know, what we saw with the Trump administration is part of a wider shift in American foreign policy. It's just the extraordinary, odd, radical version of it, but whether there is something that will stay, even today. And I think, you know, it depends what we're talking about. If we're talking about measures like the travel ban, I would say, you know, that is gone, thank God. But it doesn't mean that, I'm not talking here about just Trumpism and nationalism in the United States, which would still fuel, especially on the Republican side, would still fuel certain requests. But it's not just that. I think there are some structural changes that affected American foreign policy with Obama already, and then with Trump, and already here, still here. And one, something I mentioned before, right, is, you know, the European allies may be happy with Biden, but doesn't change the fact that China will matter a little bit more to the United States now than in the past. And, you know, in a sense, Americans' attention is like a mixed blessing, right? You want them to care for you. I mean, the Europeans have been complaining about the Americans all the time, but they want that attention, but not too much. And, you know, I think, yes, a big country like the United States can do both, but there is a shift, a structural shift to more attention to East Asia more generally. And I think that is going to stay, period. Whether that means more conflict or not, it doesn't mean that. It means just more attention, relatively more attention. And that's one. Second, this, you know, this goes back to Sarah's question, you know, big military endeavors in the Middle East, big occupations like that will be more difficult, right? Which, you know, there's this fear of getting involved in Middle East and North Africa right now. So that will also stay. And that affected Obama, but also affected Trump. I mean, remember that at least in the discourse was like, I'm not going to go around the world promoting democracy, doing liberal interventionism and all that. And even with Biden, that will have more of that approach. You know, it's still intervention light, only if needed. You know, don't do regime change. You don't do sort of, these are structural shifts, which, by the way, let me stress this, doesn't mean not that there won't be more, any more interventions. I think I've always said this from the beginning. I'm always the kind of guy in the room who says interventions will still happen. I mean, if they happen with Obama, he arrived at the White House with a clear point on this. No more Iraqs, right? No more never-ending wars. But events on the ground are different. When you're on the seat, the presidency is completely different, okay? So I think these changes are here to stay. And I don't think, you know, and even with Iran, where Biden is very clear that they want to go back to the deal because it is a good deal for them, right? I mean, they don't see this from the Republican perspective, that this is not good enough. But even there, there will be challenges. So for me, and this is what I will be discussing with my students in the IR317 course, is exactly to what extent there are some recurrent patterns between Obama, Trump, and potentially with Biden that are about different forms of engagement or even different forms of retrenchment, you know, compared to a shift in international order, the shift in, you know, the increasing polarization that doesn't sustain a particular policy at all. For me, this is the big story, if anything, but it's open for questions and debate. But this is, to me, the big story. But maybe I'm just a structuralist thinker. You know, for me, people matter up to a point, unless they're revolutionaries. Then they matter a lot. But leaders, we can't change leaders. I mean, who needs leaders, right? But again, maybe that's my theoretical bias, Jeremy. Okay. I've answered that. The one-term president, that is also very interesting for me because of the discussion I have in that course that I was referring to. I personally don't know if you're right. There is this expectation, by the way. I think you're absolutely right. But you know, would Biden actually be thinking in that way up to the point that this will affect his foreign policy thinking? I don't know. To be honest, I it's a bit of a stretch. I don't know enough about this. The other thing to keep an eye on, however, is that, you know, the first terms are usually quite different, right, from the second terms. There are two things to keep an eye on. One, you want to be reelected, and I think Biden wants to be reelected or help Democrats get reelected. And second, there's a tendency to use force a little bit more for different reasons. You know, we think, well, if you want to get elected, you don't want to risk fighting a war. But actually, sometimes you fight a war because you want to get reelected. Okay, so just keep an eye on these elements. First terms are a little bit problematic. But on your question, I don't think it will affect much on that sort, unless he really, you know, it would be odd for him to think that, you know, re-election is not on the cards and should not be on the cards. I think, you know, then why bother be a president for one term? That would be my reaction, but, you know, I may be wrong on this.
We have one more question, Luca, if you have the time.
Yeah, as I said, you're taking me away from other meetings, so I'm going to blame you, so I'm fine.
Perfect. So Dean asks how the Biden administration will respond to North Korea. Will they take a more strategic patience route, or will they have a more proactive approach? If you would like to expand on that.
That's a good one. I've got to be honest, Dean, I haven't thought about this enough because I was much more focused on looking at how things are developing on the Iran file, because it's much closer to my research interest, and it's one thing that I've always followed. So, and the China file. But on the North Korea, I would say that you're quite close to the mark, in my opinion. I haven't seen anything kind of any major difference from the Obama administration's kind of approach so far, at least in the way they've been thinking and talking about this. The only slight different thing, again, is this increased focus on democracy. You know, this idea that, you know, you shouldn't go around, you know, and, you know, shake too many hands that are ever be problematic. And this, however, goes in the same direction. So I think this kind of big symmetry with North Korea, I don't see Biden getting any major rewards in the short term from that. Whereas Trump could still say, look, I'm the king of the deal here, right? I can do that, I can deliver, but, you know, it doesn't lead to much. I don't see that happening. So I would agree with your first part. I think at the moment, if I had to bet money, I would bet on the more kind of strategic patience. Unless, of course, North Korea crosses any big red line here. But really big red line. I mean, it really endangers, you know, Japan, it really endangers. But then in that case, you know, basic symmetry could still help, right? The only thing is that maybe the only thing that I would say against my own position in this is that Trump has changed things a little bit now. He's really helped, right, North Korea have a certain image. He has done all these things to praise and to please the leader, the supreme leader, right? I think in a sense that is, in a sense, has changed the calculus a little bit. Okay, so that is the only thing that I've factored in. So to what extent that is now something that will be required by North Koreans now. But personally, I haven't investigated this much. I would more lean to the strategic patience one part.
Due to a Zoom complication, our recording was cut short, but we do hope you enjoyed listening to our conversation. Many thanks to our speaker, Dr. Luca Tardelli, and to you for listening to this episode. The music for this podcast was produced by Ash Lyle Mussing. For more information on the Grimshaw Club and Beaver Sound, check out our social media and websites.